It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
How did our media go crazy? It's the Will Kane Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. You can watch the Will Kane Podcast on Rumble or on YouTube. Today, an absolutely fascinating conversation about how our media went from biased to agenda-driven to propagandist to yelling in insanity, shuffling around in its house slippers and a robe, silence. How our media went crazy. Steve Krakauer has a new book out. It's entitled Uncovered: How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. It's out for sale today, wherever you get your books. I know, Steve, we go a ways back. We are friends. Steve and I met at CNN about 2010. Our careers walked together for a little while. He was working in the social media as an executive in social media for CNN, working with Piers Morgan Tonight, New Day, then The Morning Show, and the relaunch of Crossfire. He then at times went over and worked with The Blaze, where I was also working. At The Blaze, Steve helped produce The Kane Conversation, an early interview show I had at The Blaze with some fascinating conversations back then with guys like Gary Vaynerchuk or country music star Charlie Daniels. I then went on to ESPN. Today, Steve is the executive producer of The Megyn Kelly Show, and he writes a newsletter called Fourth Watch, which is an intelligent criticism of the media. Steve would, I think, not describe himself as left or right. He is a guy of general goodwill who wants to trust other people, and he wants the best for the media. Well, he's written this book as a diagnosis of what's happened to the media over the last decade plus, how it simply went insane. What makes this book different is he's got, I don't know how many dozens of interviews with media figures whom you know on the record with direct quotes. There are quotes in here from Tucker Carlson, Bob Lee of ESPN, Maria Bartiromo, Ben Smith of the New York Times, David Folkenflik of NPR, Eric Wimple of the Washington Post, Ali Velshi of MSNBC, Rick Sanchez, once of CNN, and he has numerous quotes in here from your very own Will Kane, once of CNN, once of ESPN, now of Fox News. It really goes into why we lost the media to bias, and then how it then in turn lost its mind to propaganda, to where it now is looking to just censor and silence all of its opponents. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. I think you will enjoy the book, Uncovered. You should go pick it up. I think we all want to know, because in a way, how we lost the media was how we lost our public conscience, how we all lost really our collective mind. Here is Steve Krakauer. All right, Steve, man, I'm really glad to have you here on the podcast today. And I think it's only appropriate we start with probably one of the most insightful comments in the entire book, Uncovered. It's by somebody, I have his name somewhere here.
Will Kane?
Will Kane. It's Will Kane. Correct. Good guess. Will Kane, who said the following to you among the many interviews you have in the book, on the record interviews with people in the media, I said to you that I believe, in reference to CNN, that I watched them over a 7 or 8 year period evolve from an institution that is simply biased people's opinions, inevitably on the left, making their way into the news, into an institution that was driven by agenda, we must stop Donald Trump, to the modern day incarnation, or at least the incarnation that it was approximately 12 months ago, where it was a propaganda-driven organization, meaning it was not only driven by the need to stop Donald Trump, but you would shape truth and even perpetuate lies in service of a moral truth. We'll talk about more about that in just a moment. But what my question for you is it's based upon my analysis, my characterization, my indictment of the media. Do you agree? What do you think is the diagnosis? Is our media biased? Is it propaganda?
Yeah. And I think, what, first of all, that was a great quote in the book. And I'm glad, you know, a lot of the quotes from you and from others, the editor let me really just put the whole thing in there, which I think is important to get the full context of it. And that was a great one. I think that the first thing we should say is that you're in that CNN chapter talking about the evolution of CNN. And you and I were at CNN, and we actually met at CNN. At a really different time for that network. I know I was there until 2013, which is less than 10 years ago, and it was like a completely different place, as you say, biased at that point, but pre-propaganda. And yes, I think there absolutely was a shift that we've seen at CNN and throughout the rest of the corporate press. I mean, certainly not just CNN, broadcast outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, you know, we're making broad generalizations, but really across the industry during the Trump era. And the question is, I think, why? I mean, is it that they wanted to insert their opinions into everything they did? Or, as I kind of write about it, and what I think maybe is probably a combination, but what I really think is definitely true also, is they on purpose took the guardrails off of editorial and sort of the ethics of journalism. And they did so by design. They believed, I think some people legitimately believed, that Donald Trump was an existential threat. Was this they had to save democracy. And some people probably didn't believe that. They probably thought, oh, this is good for business. But definitely some people in that newsroom at CNN and elsewhere really believed that. And in response to that belief, they decided that we have to meet this by completely abandoning our principles, by we have to actually, you know, change the editorial guidelines so that we can meet this threat, because it's so important. We just have to abandon it all. And I would say that I personally do not believe there was an existential threat at all. But even if I did, even if I put them, give them that at their word, okay, there is this. What I would argue is much better solution is to double down on your principles. That's when you really need to have your editorial standards. Because if you really think this is a big threat, you need to convince the public. And the only way you're going to do that is by being fair, being honest, being trustworthy. And they went the complete opposite direction and had the complete opposite effect.
So, Steve, this is an evolution that I have gone through, seeing the media as biased and now seeing the media as propagandist. I'm not sure if it's my evolution or if it is, as you just diagnosed, the actual evolution of the media. But I wasn't just talking about CNN in this conversation today, and you appropriately expanded it to the media at large. I think the person that best characterized this, that gave this voice, actually, Steve, in my estimation, was Sam Smith, the author, the noted atheist, the intellectual, who said that it was okay. I can't remember the story off the top of my head, Steve. I think it was it about Russia collusion. And it was okay to tell lies about Donald Trump if it served stopping Donald Trump. That what you just said was
Sam Harris.
It's not Sam Smith. Sam Smith is the musician.
Sam Harris. Yes.
Sam Harris, not Sam Smith. But Sam Harris, in my mind, embodying some demonic costumes here and suggesting it's okay to tell lies in service of the moral truth. He said what everyone else had already done.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. No, that was such a big moment. I know you've talked about this when he said that on the podcast fairly recently, and he got a lot of blowback for it, and then tried to explain it. And essentially said, yeah, this, you know, the Donald Trump was a giant threat, so we needed to do that. I think that started this path, because it didn't end with Donald Trump either. And I actually think it got worse and more pernicious when it relates to COVID. And another topic that I know you've talked a lot about, but this is one where it's we need to protect the public. And in order to protect the public, we need to put narrative over truth, so that we can corral people into doing what we think is the appropriate scientific action. And that leads to censorship, that leads to, you know, essentially misinformation being put out under the guise of stopping misinformation. And yeah, as you talk about, the idea that this is such a threat, just like Donald Trump, we need to abandon our principles in order to meet that threat. I think a lot of people shared Sam Harris's point of view, and sadly, it has the opposite effect. We need a strong media that's trustworthy, that has principles that we can trust and we can rely on, and they're doing the opposite and having the opposite effect.
Here's why I keep kind of, at least to begin our conversation, go down the path of bias versus propaganda. So you go in the book, and in this book, you lay out your thoughts in detail, to be quite honest, with conversations you and I have had in the past that I've had with many people in the past about why the media is biased. But it's, I think the why is different. I think the why is different if we diagnose it as bias versus propaganda. And I want to go into that in just a moment, but let's stick with propaganda for just a moment. If, as you've suggested, and I think as well, we have arrived at a place where most of the mainstream corporate media is openly propagandist, can it be saved? I know you love the quote unquote media. I know you do. You come from this you do this not from a place of, I love to kick the media shins in order to get clicks. You come from this, you come at this from a place of actually loving the media. And I know you presume the capability that it can be saved. But if it's propagandist, can you save CNN? Can you save the Washington Post? Can you save the New York Times? Can you save NBC?
I think the answer is no. No, you're not going to turn a propagandist organization into a trusted news source in any capacity. And I think, you know, CNN, we've talked about, you know, around this a little bit, you know, they're going through a major restructuring. Right. Chris Licht has come in, has replaced the Jeff Zucker era. And there's a mandate now to reinstall news and fairness and to move away. And I would say objectivity, which is actually another point we should talk about. And the question is, how do they do that? And I think what they're finding, we have Don Lemon, who's been serving out a lengthy re-education suspension of some kind, but apparently is coming back on the air. I don't think you can do that with people whose reputations journalistically are so tarnished to the average American, and then just have them kind of switch gears and all of a sudden become this reputable news source. I think it's going to take a lot more cleanup in order to do that. And I also look at places like the Washington Post, this democracy dies in darkness BS. That's another organization where, again, good work is being done at the Washington Post every day, but it is consistently undermined every day by its own reporters on Twitter and elsewhere. That's ruining not only their own reputations, but the reputation of the Washington Post. And you cannot get back to principles if you have that still happening. So yeah, it needs to be a full restructuring. It's not an easy process. It's a long road. I think it can be done. And I think the American public is generally a forgiving public, but you are not going to get there if you just kind of reshuffle the deck chairs and hope for the best.
So when I was reading your book and I lived all of it, you and I and our time in the media has basically mirrored one another. You know, basically it starts in about 2010 and goes through present day. And so as you kind of went through the stories of our time, you know, I remember thinking in real time, and I thought when I was reading your book as well, this is the big one. This is the moment that lifts the wool over everyone's eyes. This is the one that shows how incredible this institution or this individual or these voices or this point of view have actually become. Whether or not it was Covington or it was Michael Brown, hands up, don't shoot.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it was just, or the Wuhan COVID lab leak theory, or the Tom Cotton editorial. I can't tell you how many times, Steve, I thought, well, now it's undeniably too obvious, only to continue to be outdone by the next absurdity of either a lie, a truth, or censorship. Do you think we're continuing to spiral? Did we hit a peak at any point? Is any of this sort of the eye-opening moment, or are we still circling the drain?
I would add one more to your list. I thought it was Hunter Biden laptop. I really thought, okay, you know, you did it in the moment, the Hunter Biden laptop suppression. I described the elite censorship collusion racket between the government agencies, between tech companies, and between the media. We saw that in real time at the time. We've certainly seen that since with the Twitter files. And now we also see reporting like with CNN and the New York Times that, oh, the laptop's real. Okay, now we get our introspection. And then just last week, the Washington Post is running cover for James Clapper and the way the media covered that story to begin with. So no, they have not learned any lessons from that. And that was not the turning point that I thought it might be. I will maybe shine one positive light on maybe a sign that the pendulum is swinging back in a positive direction. And that's what happened last week with the New York Times and that trans controversy that they gotten themselves involved in. The New York Times has done some pretty basic reporting, and they're not drawing any real conclusions about trans and children, done some decent reporting along with other reporting that they've done on the opposite direction, and drew the ire of GLAAD and all of these activists and also current and former staffers at the New York Times. And they told those staffers not that we're going to adjust our reporting, but no, the reporting was right. And excuse me, you cannot be signing activist letters against us if you are an employee here. So that's a pendulum swing in the right direction, because it actually mirrors what happened with the Tom Cotton situation only a couple years ago, when the lowest levels in that newsroom were able to galvanize the Twitter mob and under claims that an opinion column by a senator put lives in danger and get the top editor fired. So we are actually seeing things moving potentially in the right direction. Now, I will say trans issues versus race is kind of we're talking about two different things. And so maybe one is more, you know, galvanizing than the other. But I'm somewhat hopeful on that. I don't think it's going to be long lasting, but we need moments like that to say this can be done. You just have to stand your ground in when it comes to having some credibility in the newsroom.
I think you were more hopeful about the Hunter Biden laptop story than I might have been, because I knew it would always be poured through the prism of Republican and Democrat. It's like one I didn't mention in the list I just gave, which is in your book as well, is Jussie Smollett. And it's just like when you arrive at a moment like Jussie Smollett, it just becomes so undeniable. And for any rational person, it should be sort of the break in the dam at which you start to think critically about all the other stories you're being told. So I want to go into why and how we got here. When I first joined Fox, Steve, I had this conversation on air with Lara Logan, and I wanted to have this conversation because Lara, like me and like you, the thing about when you talk about the media, and people sometimes say this to me, you're the media. And that's true. When we talk about the media shorthand, I don't know what we mean, mainstream media, corporate media. But I know that if there is mainstream corporate media, inside of that universe, Fox is the black sheep. So for those of us that have worked outside of Fox, like myself at CNN or ESPN or Larry Logan at CBS, we have, I think, some unique insight into the mindset of those institutions, or at least we did. Yeah. And I told Lara that I believed at the time they were mainly driven by bias. And she was like, that's cute. That's naive. They're driven by purpose, agenda, and propaganda. And I think that she has either the times moved her way or she was always more insightful than I might have been, granting my goodwill. But I'm going to go deeper into that with you in a moment, because I think there's a place, there's areas that they've always been propagandist and areas where it's simply been biased. So let's start with the idea that it was always biased, that evolved into some propaganda. And I want you, as you do in the book, to start, and we'll have to make this a conversation because you've had so many reasons. You lay out some reasons why. Why is the media so biased to the left?
Yeah, well, the short answer is, and by working at places like a CNN or CBS or ESPN, which I do also write about in the book, ESPN is another case study here. For decades, the media has, you can, I think, honestly say, leaned left. It's populated by people largely in New York and D.C., the Acela media, as I describe it, people that, as you actually point out in the book, even people that are from other places throughout the country are the one, the people that end up in New York and D.C. are the people that want to leave their hometowns in a lot of cases. And that says something also. And so you have a general kind of bubble point of view that comes along with this. And that has been this way for decades. I mean, it's been populated by people that are largely liberal, largely vote for Democrats. And yet it's gotten so much worse in such a real and tangible way in just the last 5 to 7 years. What is that? And I will point to one aspect of it, and I think that's Twitter. And I think you and I have talked a lot about Twitter on and offline. I have a very love-hate relationship with Twitter. in that I love it and I hate myself for loving it. But I think it's a real, real, it's a real, real problem. I mean, the idea that you can now see every thought from every reporter, that even if they're doing good work, you can then see what they think, not just about even their own stories, but just anything. And you just look at it and sometimes you're just like, what an idiot. Like, what are you even talking about?
Right.
The fact that it so exposes people, that's one big problem. And then the other big problem with Twitter that I think has made this entire bias propaganda situation worse is the incentive structure that happens on Twitter, is that now you are incentivized to cover stories a certain way or disincentivized to cover stories at all because of what might happen from a few, I mean, hundreds, maybe. We're talking like 20 to 50 to 100 people yelling at you or saying great job. It can have such a real effect on the way journalists operate these days. And that's a huge problem also.
Okay. I actually want to push back on two things that you just laid out. I don't think it is a problem. I think it is good that Twitter lets us inside the minds of those various journalists, because that mindset was always there. It was going to make its way into the reporting, and now we at least get to see the honest truth behind them. That's not a problem of Twitter, in my estimation. The second one, I agree with. I would only push back on one thing. As a member of the media, I'll tell you this. Positive, well, I don't know. Maybe it's different for every person. Positive feedback, like you said, positive or negative by like 20 people can massively influence what you do. It's weird, man. Positive encouragement doesn't do much. You lay this out in the book. You analogize it to Pascal's wager with the journalists on the need to get it right versus the need to be acceptable. That it is more, you're more incentivized to be acceptable and wrong, to be right and to be unacceptable. And look, man, I've personally lived that. You know that. I was unacceptably right. And when I say right, I mean correct. At ESPN for a long time. And the incentive is to go the opposite. It is to be wrong, but popular. And to me, that's where Twitter comes in with the negative reinforcement mechanism. And we'll go into all of these things. But one of the reasons I think that media is biased is sheer cowardice. I actually think there's just, and maybe media is not unique in that way. And I don't care if some of my fellow, I know this, I know it. I've seen it play out in front of my eyes. People are deathly afraid, afraid of being called a racist, afraid of being canceled, afraid of being ostracized, afraid of losing in-group status, whatever it may be. But it is, Twitter has become the muscle of what I know now was really one of the primary human motivators, which is cowardice.
Yeah, and I do. I agree with you. I'm as a person who covers the media, am just grateful every day that Twitter exists, because we get to see this on full display. And there's so many examples of it. Some I read about in the book where you can literally match a way a reporter covers a story with the way they were talking about it before they covered that story, and you just know exactly what they were looking for before they actually started down that path. So I agree with you on that. I want to talk about Pascal's wager also, but I think I will just say, I think that you are someone who's somewhat unique in the media, in the sense that you are someone who is super introspective and self-aware, and I don't want to say self-critical, but you're constantly looking and thinking about you know, things on a deeper level. And that's probably why the positive reinforcement doesn't necessarily have the impact it does on other journalists. But I will say,
interesting.
I mean, I look at pundits across the Wajahat Ali is just someone who's just kind of popped in my head, is someone who just says the craziest things possible and gets essentially rewarded with more cable news hits, you know, book deal, but also Twitter. I mean, he's rewarded because people like give him snaps with retweets and everything, and it's like a drug in that way, I think, for a lot of people. That maybe it doesn't have that same effect for you, but I do think that is a negative forces that people treat this as if it matters. Real quick, Pascal's wager. So in the book, I lay out Pascal's wager, philosophical term on the belief in God. It's basically you're better to believe in God than to not believe in God, because if you're right about that, then big reward. If you're wrong, then not such a bad outcome. If you're right that there's no God, that's a small reward. And if you're wrong that there's no God, bad outcome. So the better wager is to believe in God. And I think that matches up well with the media. I think in the Jussie Smollett situation, we saw one news outlet and I news outlet in a very quote unquote term, and I believe it was Entertainment Tonight, wrote that Jussie Smollett was allegedly attacked in a allegedly racist or homophobic attack, and got completely pilloried for daring to use terms like allegedly by AOC and by others, including people in the media. And instead, so they were right, but they made the wrong choice, essentially, in this current incentive structure, which is a mess, to cover things in a proper way. They would be better off to get the story wrong and not face the wrath of Twitter. And that's a huge, huge problem, because most people don't operate that way. Most people in the real world have families and lives, and they go outside and they don't spend all day on Twitter. And they see this and are embarrassed by it and are grossed out by it.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Yeah, and to me, that's an example of that negative incentive structure that I think people respond so, that is such a strong influence. But I'm hearing you. I think that's interesting that other people, also, maybe people other than me respond to the positive side of the incentive structure as well. That brings me to this. I want to ask you this. Former colleague of mine, a guy who I've continued to stay in touch with that I didn't actually know well when I was at ESPN, Ethan Strauss, gave you a quote. And he said to you, you guys were talking, and he said, I am fascinated by how many people fake it. That he thinks a lot of people in media don't believe what they say. Now, when I was at ESPN, I don't want to name names, but anybody that's ever worked at ESPN, producers even behind the scenes, we used to laugh about some personalities that would climb to the top of the mountain of an obviously safe take. Okay? So in other words, like, stand on the table and say, I just won't stand for domestic violence. And we'd be like, oh, awesome. And as though you were fighting some big pro-domestic violence constituency out there, right?
That's not a first take argument.
Clearly, see, that person is either seeking positive feedback or doing their best to avoid ever garnering the negative spotlight. But it's a little seed of fake. But I've been told recently, by the way, Steve, about other media personalities that I don't know well who are complete shams. I didn't know it, but I was like, that guy was a nutball. And I was like, yeah, but he didn't believe any of it. He was just doing it.
Right.
He was just doing it. And Ethan was saying to you how surprised he is to find out how many people don't believe some of the craziness that they're saying. They're just doing it. That's kind of news to me in a way. Do you think it's true? Are there a lot of actors? You know what's going viral right now is Don Lemon's clip from 10 years ago where he's given five tips to Black America. And those five tips, without a doubt, would get 2022 Don Lemon canceled. And you know who would lead the cancellation? 2022 Don Lemon of 2013 Don Lemon.
Yes.
So it does bring up the case. Yes. I mean, are a lot of these guys actors?
Let's talk about Don Lemon first. I know Don. I knew him when I was at CNN. I think Don's a nice guy. He's, to put it nicely, I don't think Don's acting. I think Don is a blank canvas and is happy to sort of put, different things. I think he's actually probably more 2013 Don Lemon than 2022 Don Lemon, but I don't think he's really necessarily doing it for any other purpose than he's just evolved into wherever the wind, takes him. Now, I think, though, Ethan's point is 100% true. And it gets to the cowardice point that you're talking about. I think there are certainly people that are doing it for financial reasons, right? They're acting as a means to get that next contract or to get promoted. But I also think there's a level of it takes a lot to put yourself out there intellectually now in this current environment, as crazy as that sounds. And people that you would think, even people that sort of position themselves as brave truth tellers are often hiding, whether through a bias of omission or something else, they're hiding their true beliefs or their true understanding. I'm amazed, Will, and this is just a small scale thing. There are a lot of people that read Fourth Watch, the newsletter that I write, and will send me things, and people that are in the media. And when I go to talk to them and see if they would talk publicly, they won't do it. And I don't think I'm some super controversial person, but just the idea of talking in a forum that could potentially get them a mild backlash is something that is over the line for certain people. And I think it's a combination of cowardice and faking it in order to whether benefit financially or benefit culturally.
So let's go back to the idea again. It's sort of the precursor to propaganda. It's the media as I understood it for most of my life. And I think I always understood mostly. Maybe not. When I was growing up and my mom had on Matt Lauer and Katie Couric, I think when I was a teenager, I didn't know that they were biased probably in the beginning. It took some of my own education, which really probably started in law school for me, to start seeing the lies of omission or the lies of story selection or whatever it may be. But you talk a lot about geographic bias, and you brought it up. And I think geographic bias is big. And I told you in the book, and you've already referenced it, that there are media companies, though. I mean, there's a lot of people. If you go inside Fox or you go inside CNN or ESPN or whatever it may be, not everybody is from Connecticut, right? Not everybody is from Massachusetts or Virginia. There's people from all over. There's guys from small town Texas, smaller than where I grew up, that I got to know. But they are sort of cultural converts. In your book, I said there are people that hated their hometown. And I didn't like the way that I said that in your book, which I'm sure I said it that way. I'm not questioning the quote. I think what they are people who may have felt ostracized in their small hometown, or maybe they were liberal, or maybe they were gay, or maybe they were a minority or whatever. And in their own small hometown, they didn't feel at home. And they saw New York or Washington, D.C. as a rival, as cultural commonality. And so what you get is still geographic bias in that everyone is culturally of that geographic ilk. You know what I mean? You have very few people in those newsrooms who are from, like Dana Perino from Wyoming, who still has some of that sensibility of Wyoming, or me, who has that sensibility of Texas. If you have people from those places, they're a little bit indistinguishable from the person who grew up on the Upper West Side.
Yeah. Oh, totally true. I mean, culturally, so there's a sameness to it. And I think it cuts across party lines also. You know, I think that we see a lot of, I write about like the Bernie Sanders 2020 story as a case study in the book, where, you know, Bernie Sanders was sort of screwed over in 2016 by the political establishment. But in 2020, it was the political establishment, but it was also the media. When they were really freaked out, MSNBC and to a lesser extent CNN galvanized around Joe Biden to ensure that Bernie Sanders wasn't going to be the Democratic nominee, whether they didn't like his politics, they didn't think he could beat Trump. I mean, and that's not an easy cut down the middle to say, oh, this is just political bias. So yeah, I think that there's a real sameness that happens there. And what we get from that is really a false idea of what the country looks like. I don't want to say, you know, some of my best friends are gay, but some of my closest friends, actually really my closest friends in Dallas that I met when I moved to Dallas are gay. Some of them voted for Trump. Some of them, all of them are big time Second Amendment gun owners, often shoot much more than I do. Some are, you know, gay married. No one is as neatly in a cable news punditry box when you're in a place like Dallas, especially, which is, you know, essentially 50-50 red, blue, but across the country. And I also think this shows up in the way things get covered. I think it's a pretty rough time right now in terms of the way we're interacting with each other. But I think it's better than it's being portrayed in a lot of ways by places like, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, about the tenor of the country. Everything's on edge. No, I think a lot of people who have differing points of views, you know, slightly differing points of views or complicated points of views, get along just fine a lot of times. So yeah, I think it's a huge problem when people move out of those places, move to a newsroom in New York or D.C., and then just get acculturated to the sameness that we see across the board on the media.
So you don't agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene that we're ready for a national divorce?
No, I don't. I don't. I think that there are forces that benefit from dividing the country. And every day I'm encouraged by forces that I think are working against that. And I was just watching Tucker Carlson the other night talking about, I think, in a way of how do we lower the temperature? How do we get together with, you know, our neighbors? We just shouldn't be relying on Washington or any party. We should be relying on each other, our communities. I don't think we're headed for a national divorce. I think we're headed for, if anything, a divorce from from the establishment in the corporate press and the establishment on you know, potentially both sides of the aisle. I know we saw that in 2016 a bit with Trump. We'll see what happens now. But the mood of anti-establishment, anti-elite sentiment is stronger than ever and actually is a uniting force, I think.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
I want to come back to establishment. I want to come back to Bernie Sanders, and I'm going to return to propaganda, but I'm going to stick with bias for just a moment. So I think we're laying out some of the factors, geographic bias. There's another one, and you have alluded to it when you talk about, you know, the people that stay in middle America versus the people that choose to move and become part of the culture that the media then becomes the flag for, a cultural commonality that the media becomes the standard bearer. And it's this, I think every industry has a self-selection mechanism. The media is no different, right? So there's certain kinds of guys that go into finance. There's certain kinds of guys here in Texas who go into real estate, right? And not to be like, yeah, Everybody's the same, but there are stereotypes. You live here, sure, Steve, and I'll introduce you to some of my friends. You can play the game pretty quick. Real estate? Yeah, he's in real estate. You know, whatever it may be. There's a self-selection mechanism to businesses, and there is a self-selection mechanism to media. The people that choose to go into media are largely people who already held these liberal beliefs. And I think that's in part because of the way that media has defined itself. I think I said this on MSNBC a long time ago. I think I was a guest on Morning Joe, which wasn't very often. And I think it's H.L. Mencken, who's one of the like godfathers of print media. And he said, the job of the media is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And I think that was for a long time the standard bearer, or at least the front facing flag of the media. And that attracted a certain ideology on the left, and that attracted a certain type of person to join the media. That's not the job of media, to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable, in my estimation. I mean, there are poor people that lie and rich people that tell the truth, you know, and I think the job of the media is to tell the truth. So in other words, I think that another reason for the bias is that people are just choosing a business that kind of fits who they are anyway.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. It's like the self-selection bias of who joins an industry. And that's why I think we need to, as an industry, you know, as the journalism leaders of today, would be well served by trying to recruit people that have to kind of be convinced to become journalists. People that are not, that don't want to be journalists in some ways. I've been thinking about this.
Hey, Steve, real quick. I don't think if you want to go into journalism, don't get a journalism degree. Yeah. That's an advice, piece of advice I would get. I mean, what made me, in my own humble estimation, is my law degree. That's the tool that I use more than any other in journalism.
Yeah, I can say as someone with a broadcast journalism degree, the only real use of it is the networking aspects of it. You know, the way I've been able to you went to Newhouse for broadcast. Yeah, that's kind of which is a sad commentary for it. No shots at it. I'm not saying there's anything against getting a degree either, but you certainly don't need it. I don't think you need a degree at all to be a journalist. It's not a job requirement. You're not a pilot or a doctor. You're just trying to tell people stories and tell the truth. But I also think one of the big problems is we recruit people who want to not only be journalists, but they want to be somewhat famous. They want to be influencers in a way. And before social media, certainly decades ago, journalists were essentially like disliked. They were annoying. And I think we need to get back to that. Journalists should be nosy, like in a negative way. Like you should be annoying people every day, annoying people in power. Yes, you know, the general public should be respectful. They should respect what you do and the work that you do, but you should be fairly unknown and you should be essentially annoying. Like you should be pests, you know, gnats on people in power that bother them every day. We don't get that at all. Now, I would say somewhat guilty of it also. Look, I'm trying to, you know, sell a book and trying to get out there and raise a profile. Sure. But that's not the goal of a journalist. That should not be the goal of a journalist. And when it is the goal, really bad mistakes can get made.
So I want to turn now to propaganda and the part that I think Larry Logan was right. And I think that both of us could have been right about bias and propaganda. I think I've become more cynical towards what you just described a moment ago as the establishment. And I do think it crosses political boundaries. I don't think it's evenly distributed for what it's worth. I don't think it's 50-50. Right. I think it is more incentivized on the left because the left, and there's a reason for that. It's because the left inhabits governmental positions of establishment more than small C conservatives, not neocons. There's a lot of incentive in that structure. And so that's what I want to get to. When you told the story of Bernie Sanders in your book, in both 16 and 20, what you in there, when you get to that story, to me, that highlights a propaganda that has existed, in my estimation, Steve, longer than the last 5 years. Look, the country lost its mind and the media lost its mind. And it's best exemplified by CNN losing its mind in going from bias to propaganda. But the Bernie Sanders story you tell is the type of propaganda that I think was probably present going back decades. That there is a certain realm of acceptable thought and acceptable politician, and we will do what it takes. Hillary Clinton will take over the DNC. The media will aid her in 2020 to ensure this time, not a conservative, but Bernie Sanders does not threaten this established power. And you bring up in the book, Donald Trump overcame that when it came to the RNC. But it isn't because they didn't try. They did not want Donald Trump to be the nominee for the Republican Party. And I think that establishment still exists today, both parties, Washington, D.C., and in the media, and they traffic in propaganda.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that Donald Trump got the most right in 2015 and 2016 was the whole drain the swamp conversation. And it's not just about Washington, D.C. I think it resonated with people because there's a lot of truth to it. And as you mentioned, it cuts across party lines. And yeah, sure, maybe not, you know, not 50-50. But no, there's the acceptability. I think I write about it as consensus versus counter consensus. It's only gotten worse because of social media and the way that the consensus narrative can gel and can really be propagated much easier now. You don't have to send it in like secret email lists. You can just kind of do it on Twitter, and just it's amazing to go. And the people have done these great supercuts of people, you know, pundits, journalists just saying the same thing. And I can tell you, it's not because they get some email. They're just reading Twitter and just oh, this is something that went viral, and so that's what I'm going to say. That's a good talking point. And then it just becomes the establishment talking point. So yeah, I think it's gotten worse. I do agree. I think it's always been there, the propaganda of protecting the establishment, not rocking the boat too much. And it also really probably speaks to how they lost their mind. They lost their mind because for the first time they couldn't stop the non-establishment candidate, Donald Trump, from becoming the nominee and then becoming president. And it was such a shock to the system. I always remember Jorge Ramos, I think, who talked about on election night eating milk and cookies like he was a little child, because it just brought him back to his childhood. It was such a shock to his system that he didn't really know how to cope with the election of Donald Trump, not just because he was scared of Donald Trump, but because he just could never have fathomed it. I never met anyone who voted for Donald Trump. You know, it's like what the thought process is there. And then what do you get from that? You get this complete overreaction and just the pendulum swing the other direction, which continued through COVID, made everything worse. And it's because they for the first time felt the quicksand beneath them actually start to erode. And now it's like, well, if this can happen, anything can happen.
Yeah, and the media has become the enforcer for, as you described it, the consensus, where once that idea that we will afflict the comfortable probably meant you would speak truth to the power of government and the wealthy. Now they're the enforcers of the comfortable. Now, you know, no one has benefited more from this idea of consensus, scientific consensus, acceptability consensus, free speech consensus. No one has benefited more in the last 3 to 5, 7 years than the establishment. I mean, how easy is it to manipulate the media? Now, that being said, let's talk about the future of media now, because part of the freak out, Steve, of our recent history is, okay, the iron fist is dropping on consensus, and we've fully metastasized now, even beyond propaganda, into the censorship era of media, right? Like, now just silence those that you disagree with. But in part, that's a reaction to the fact that they can't drop the iron fist on the
ecosystem of media, Substack, podcasts, Joe Rogan, Matt Taibbi, Elon Musk. It's honestly the wild, wild west right now. So you and I can complain, and we should, about where we are with in terms of establishment, corporate, mainstream media. But there's a ton of access to information right now. So let's talk about the future. I asked you earlier, can corporate mainstream media be saved? You know what? You told me, I remember this one time, you and I were sitting in a restaurant in Columbus Circle, and you told me, man, this is 5 to 7 years ago. You told me the future of media is small audiences. That's the future. Small, devoted audiences. Mm. So what's the future?
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that. This is another reason why I'm hopeful, to be honest, is because, yeah, you can build an audience yourself on social media, YouTube, on Substack, on podcast platforms, and you can speak directly to them. You can, quote unquote, tell the truth, and you can operate outside of the gatekeepers now. And I will say, I talked to enough executives at various news outlets. They're noticing this. This is a very real thing, and it threatens their business model. But it also, I think on some level, there's potential for what can we do with this? How do we build on this in a way that can benefit us, can benefit potentially the independent outlets and let them retain some independence? So I'm hopeful in that sense, I think, as well. Because as much as small audiences is great, you know, to do really important work, you need resources. You need a legal department, potentially. You need financial backing. We need to be able to empower smaller outlets, smaller individuals, to reach a wide audience as well. And so some of it will happen organically, and then some of it I think needs to happen through executives. But when Joe Rogan can become the most powerful force in the media, that says that the media that was, quote unquote, the media before is not doing their job, is not holding court. You know, they're not holding serve, and someone else is going and taking that mantle, and that it should excite everybody. I mean, really, like anyone on any side, consensus or not consensus, everyone should be excited that people from the left to the right, to the progressives, to the MAGA side, can build a platform and can beat the establishment. The only people that should be terrified are the people that are stuck in the old business model at these crusty news organizations, legacy media outlets, who are not adapting in real time. And they should be scared because, you know, the independent upstarts are turning into the establishment.
I want to ask you this. Why do we care about CNN? We do. The truth is, nobody cares about MSNBC. Like, we care a little bit when they do some really, really, because they've become the barometer of the far crazy, you know. We'll talk about what Joy Reid had to say or Rachel Maddow doing Russia collusion. Yeah. But in the end, no one really cares. They point and they laugh, right? But Joe Rogan cares about CNN. He talks about it, okay? That's the point. He doesn't talk about MSNBC. The man on the street, when I do diners for Fox and Friends, no one ever comes up to me and talks to me about MSNBC. They will say something about CNN. They poke fun at it, right? Why does America, and I mean, I'm not about the ratings, because I actually think there's a difference between ratings and relevance or even purpose. Ratings are important, but why does everyone care about CNN?
I think as someone who worked at CNN and was in the meetings with the top executives at CNN and was a fan of CNN before I ever got in the building, it always makes me laugh. Well, in Atlanta, Ben, when CNN had a big presence there, they had a CNN store, and you could buy like CNN hats and mugs and things. And there was like a CNN tour of studios. And look, I'm sure there are people who went in the store and bought a CNN hat, but that's not really what CNN was. When CNN's working properly, it is just the news. When news happens, you turn on the news, and that should be CNN. That should be a place where people go to get the truth, whether it's what's happening in Ukraine or happening in America somewhere, some natural disaster, some bomb, whatever. That should be it. You don't have fans. You don't necessarily have like people that are on the CNN team. Now, that changed in 2017 when they became the resistance. But CNN, when done right, serves a really valuable purpose. We should have a place that feels like the boring news. And you can try to make it a little bit more exciting. I'm sure Chris Licht has lots of ideas about how to do that. But ultimately, it does not do its job when people think CNN and don't think news. They think some, you know, what is Don Lemon saying today? That's a big, big brand problem for CNN. And so I think that I want the CNN I feel like I worked at in 2012 during the election cycle when I was at 10 different Republican debates and every election night, we were doing the news. We were doing what we could. There's probably, you know, small complaints that could be made there, but at least that there was a mission statement that people, you know, should care about.
Yeah. Okay. The future of me you describe, and it's one that I consume. All right. Meaning like I have multiple Substack subscriptions, including one we referenced here today in Ethan Strauss's Substack.
Yeah, me too.
And many, many others. The information is there. You can go find it. It's just hard. It takes now multiple subscriptions. It doesn't wash over you. You can't turn on the TV hardly. Look, I love Fox, so I'm not sitting here saying Fox doesn't provide. I think Fox does provide. I'm proud, and I can say that honestly. I'm proud of a lot of the people I work with at Fox and what they put out on a daily and nightly basis. It's hard to just put on anything and let it wash over you anymore. You know, and, you know, whatever that was from the 90s or maybe even the early 2000s. So, you know, while I'm telling you there's a lot of voices out there and you can get it, it doesn't come to you as easy as it used to. You have to go to it more. And that's a lot to ask.
It is.
That's a lot to ask of people, not just financially, but like just energy wise.
Time.
Who is this? Can I trust this person? How do I find it? You know, Seymour Hersh, right, who wrote the thing on Substack about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline being bombed by us, the United States. I mean, that's been a tree falling in the forest because it hasn't been covered by mainstream media.
Sure.
And if you want to read that and decide whether or not you think it's true or not, right, factor in who you think Seymour Hersh is, an anonymous source, whatever, you have to go to it. You have to go find it. It has to hit your awareness radar. And then you got to take several proactive steps. That's hard.
And that's why I think we need both, right? Like, I agree with you. At the same time, I think a lot of people found that article. I've talked to a lot of different people. People that I wouldn't normally expect to have found that article have found it in some capacity. It's because it's hard to kind of curate for yourself. It's something that doesn't just take all of your time and energy to get what you need to you know, be informed. So that is difficult. But at the same time, it's accessible. Now, I would also say, when New York Times, and I'm going to say when, New York Times, you know, CNN, Washington Post, one of those places writes a very similar story or covers it in a very similar way 6 months, a year from now, because I think that whether he got everything right, there are definitely seeds of truth in what he wrote. No, at the bare minimum, when they do that a year from now, people a lot of new people will learn about it. And a lot of us, you and I, will say, I knew that a year ago, just like the Hunter Biden laptop story. But at least
just like natural immunity, just like every story that was called a conspiracy.
I know. And so it will come. And that is why we need this to operate, you know, in both ways, because when the New York Times covers it, they have a big audience that's not finding it also. And they need to be better at surfacing some of this stuff and putting weight behind it.
Yeah, I think I used to say this when I was at ESPN, Steve, and I don't know how we'll end this interview. I feel like it should be somewhat optimistic and somewhat future-looking. But, I used to say this at ESPN. Like, people would ask me this. Like, how do I, like, who should I read? Who should I trust? And I'm like, man, I can't. I certainly can't give you. I said, you need to take time to listen and read or watch individuals, human beings, and you can be the judge of their character, if they're honest arbiters and if they're truthful. And I think one of the real tells on that for me is if they are attempting to be the voice of God, if they are attempting to silence their critics, if they're willing to hear their critics, if they're pretending they're objective when we all have bias, you know? And so I can only speak for me as one person in media. What I've tried to do is earn that trust, not ask anybody to give me it, but earn it through honesty by saying, listen, here's who I am. Here's my biases. I will share with you my viewpoint on whatever this may be, what I've learned, my reporting, if I've learned something original, or my analysis of something else that I've read. And then I will hear from you
or others that think that I'm wrong. And somewhere in that collision of honesty, we can hopefully together elevate the truth.
Yeah, I love that, man. And anyone who knows you from even your ESPN radio days knows how, I would say, unlike maybe other radio shows, even in the sports radio space, where because of that, you know, wanting that feedback, wanting that give and take, wanting to hear other people's opinions. And it's somewhat rare, you know, in that space. And so yeah, I 100% agree. I write about anti-speech activism, which I think is the biggest problem in the press, if I had to pick one. And what I think it really boils down to, what bothers me the most, is that the people that want to silence, you know, opinions and viewpoints, what's at the core there is like a fundamental distrust of the American public, of the average person. They just don't really trust you with information, or they don't trust that you can handle certain things. So we're just going to make sure you don't see that. If anyone has that, that should be kind of sniffed out and ignored. Those people are doing a disservice. They don't trust you. And one of the things that I believe is that I actually generally trust people. Like, I think most people are good. And so when you operate, I think, from that principle, and when you find other people, especially people in the media, who have that general point of view that you are someone, I respect you, I trust you without knowing you, that those are the kind of people that will steer you straight. They may get things wrong. They may not always have the correct information, but at least they're not trying to take things off your plate so you can't find them. And they respect you enough to put things out there and to respect you in the process.
I can say that is you. You are, you know, sometimes I think you are that to a fault. But in general, it is not a fault. It is a very admirable trait that you do see the best, or you extend goodwill, or you trust in some situations where I think people have showed you should not trust. But you see the best. You hope for the best in people. Last, I do want to end on an optimistic note. And you and I are buddies, so sometimes it's not a Q&A in a traditional manner. It's me sharing my opinion, you responding with yours. So I want to throw this optimistic vision at you. I was at Daytona this weekend, and I went for a walk on the beach, and I talked to my brother on the phone, and he was watching this series called The Chosen, which I believe is on Fox Nation. It's a really interesting story concept about, like, you know, the Jews being the chosen people. And then I don't know much about it, so I could be butchering the storyline, but what happened if there were a people today who professed to be the chosen people? How would modern society treat them? I think really interesting story concept, right? And then I was talking to my friend Pete's wife, who's also in this business, Pete Hegseth's wife, and we were talking about media in general and storytelling. And I was thinking that the funny thing is, whether or not we're talking about Hollywood or even what we do, news media and sports media, it's become so constipated in that it's telling a really honestly narrow band of stories and a narrow way of looking at the world. It really is narrow, and it's really far out of touch with the vast majority of America. And here's the optimistic side of this. Man, does that mean it's wide open for entrepreneurship, for like somebody willing to disrupt. And that's my vision of the media in the future. It already begun. It's going to be continue to be highly, highly disrupted. And I think that's going to be the case when it comes to movies, television series. I think that the people who've largely been in charge of telling you stories, and we're going to include the news in that, for the past half a century, are so out of touch with you and dealing with such a small bandwidth of viewpoints that you've got, like what I think it was George Will said about Roger Ailes, you've got an amazing niche, half of America. Yeah. You know, you've got a huge opportunity to talk to everyone that's been ignored, and everyone's been ignored is most of America.
Yeah. And that I'm with you. I mean, that's why I'm somewhat hopeful. And I think that the independent media that we've seen successful, and I'm not even counting Joe Rogan, I'm talking about just like individual Substacks that can gain a couple thousand people. The fact that people are seeing that and the average American is saying, oh, there is this other way, gives them a hunger for that even more, and an understanding that it doesn't, you know, we can do this completely differently. And that's why, I mean, as much as has gone on in the media, as many shifts as we've seen, and not just in the news media, but with Netflix and with Disney Plus and the way, and it, you know, we are, even as much as has already happened, it does really feel like we're at this inflection point right now, where the independent media is going to change and the corporate media is going to change. We don't know exactly how it's all going to shake out. But I really do think in the next year or two, things will look vastly different. We will consume content in different ways. The winners and the losers will be much more defined than they are right now. I think it's really, like you mentioned, the Wild West. And that's an exciting time. I mean, it can make certain people nervous. But for like you and I just kind of, you know, talking here, like it's really an exciting time in the media business and just in culture right now, because it feels really untapped. And that leads to a lot of opportunity.
That's what you're doing, you guys over there with the Megyn Kelly Show. And that's what you've written about extensively and uncovered how the media got cozy with power, abandoned its principles, and lost the people. It's a really good book. I've truly enjoyed it. You talk to so many people in there, from Selena Zito, people on the left, Tucker Carlson, former media executives, Bob Lee at ESPN, about what has gone wrong with our media. It's an awesome book, and this has been an awesome conversation. Thanks so much, Steve Krakauer.
Thanks, Will. Appreciate it.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Steve Krakauer. Once again, go pick up the book, Uncovered, How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. You will enjoy understanding exactly what went wrong, again, with on-record conversations with guys like John Roberts and Piers Morgan, with people like Joel Cheatwood, an executive at CNN and Fox. Go check it out, Uncovered. I'll see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Hi, this is Dave Anthony. Saturday marks 25 years since the Columbine School Massacre. We talked to a survivor, Craig Scott, who lost his sister but saved some classmates that day. We invite you to listen to the whole interview in our Rundown Extra, Saturday at foxnewspodcast.com.